this point, we'll begin the second half of our mini symposium. We've looked at a few keys to understanding and discerning the universal themes in world religions and the divine wisdom or God wisdom, theosophia, that underlies them all. So we can use the key of understanding what is the human predicament, the key of understanding what the system teaches about life as a school, and how to discern the real, the permanent, the enduring, the meaningful behind the temporary and illusional. And so there are four remaining keys, but they're all part of or ways to pursue the goal of the religious life. So as we will see in our next presentation, each religion and all religions teach a certain goal of the religious life. And so we'll now have a presentation on that subject. We also a parking ticket for the parking lot behind here was, so you'll need to get home.
Okay, you can sit here and smile.
Yeah, I'm gonna try.
Well, let us continue with this conversation. The goal of religious life. Well, there are really two. You know, what happens when we die? How can we make that the best ever? And is there any way of bringing this spirituality into our daily living? Well, there's an idea that runs through all religions. That is one of great compassion. Buddha exemplified that. What we see in all religions, in Christianity and Islam and in Judaism, we see this love one another. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. There's this sense of unity. But lo and behold, there's something that has come in between this unity, and it's called religion. It's called the church. It's called an intermediary between us and God. We need someone to act for us on our behalf. Now, we all know from our own backgrounds our deep religious roots and how fundamentally they are very much alike. You know, it's mentioned over and over again that what we have is a materialized sense of what spirit is. It's materialized. So everything that we read, it's on the outward plane. We don't look at it on the inward plane. You know, they say, well, in the Christians and in Islam, not so much Judaism, there's certain sects that teach reincarnation and karma, but that we die and we live in eternity. Ha, we laugh. We are in eternity. We're living in eternity now. We are. So it's just a half-baked explanation. It's the truth is found there, but it's expressed on the very material ideas. That God is not outside of us. God is within us. We are not separate from this God. We are this God. That the teachings of these religions are trying to really make us realize who we are. Now, because religion is what it is, the goal of most religious activity is to support the church, support the synagogue, support the mosque. It's an outside expression of our goodness or our need to give. And religion sort of has siphoned off that. And also the fact that there are laws that are put forth by all religions of how we should act, how we should live, how we should treat each other. But again, it's an outside influence. We are told over and over again in this ancient philosophy that we evolve from within outward. So when we adhere to outside rules and regulations, we haven't developed an understanding within ourselves of the true meaning of not killing, not stealing. Why? Why? And because we do not have that deep inner understanding, we live in a world that's corrupt. Because the inner morality has not been developed. Because it's all set, it's here. It's what you see, what you do, that's obvious to other people, that makes you a moral person. Well, religion harkens us back to the family. The family is the nucleus of this compassion for one another. And upon this nucleus, we build a nation. We build a country. We build a world. That is the basis. But religion comes along, and the church says, well, you're married to the church as well. What you do, you must do for the church as well. And again, outside structure. One of the most frightening things for any theosophist is to give up. We see these laws that we live by or these ethics that we live by. Give them up and look within. And you decide what is the moral choice that you're going to make. Well, this is what religions point to. Buddhism is one of self-exploration. It has been lost in ritual. But the esoteric understanding of Buddha is still alive in Mahayana Buddhism. It's still there. The Hinayana, which is found in the south, has lost the truths. You know, and it's basic, as was said. Reincarnation and karma, that is the fabric of our life. Well, a truer understanding of that, we can live morally. Because we do see the results of our actions. But we should not be living for them. We should be doing the best that we can. That's in all religions. But because of the materialization of this ancient religion, this ancient philosophy, this ancient science, the very fact that truth lies within these ideas is power. Is power. That is power within itself. And we have seen that religions have sprouted up with the basis in truth. But they have been circumvented. They've been made to aid an outside being. There's always a leader. The Pope always has a successor. That these ideas, there is no successorship. These ideas are the birthright of humanity. A religion can grab it and take it and say it's its own, but if you read the Bible or any of the Torah or any of the religious books, you will find theosophy. You find theosophy in Matthew, in his parables. You find it in Paul. Paul was, we're told, was initiated. He was initiated, when we say that, in this or these ideas. We are all initiated. Each one of us are initiated. And if you look at the root of Christianity, you find the Gnostics, the Essenes, the Therapeutae. You look at the root of Islam. You see Sufism. You see a teaching of unity, of oneness, of loving acts of kindness. In Judaism, you see an ancient practice that has preserved certain rituals that brings God or the spirit of unity into a family. They call it Shabbos. But when there is that love and compassion, that feeling of unity, and caring for those around you and for life in general, you bring the presence of love into the world. And it manifests in your family. The Christians do the same thing, but the ritual is not as pronounced. And in Mohammedism, they have rituals of fasting and doing Ramadan, and they have their teachers they consult with. They have their books of learning to keep the mind active so that it can aspire to truth. All these things point in one direction. There are underlying truths in all of this. And you can read every story, every parable, every lesson in the Bible, and look at it from a impersonal point of view.
So you mean to say compassion is the first step?
Did you have a question? Yeah.
Compassion?
Yeah. Just raise your hand. So we can, yes.
Just repeat your question.
You mean to say compassion is the first step?
Is compassion the first step?
Yeah.
Well, we would hope to be so fortunate that our heart is open. Okay? These teachings, they endeavor to do that. There are two doctrines, one of the heart and one of the head. Okay? The heart doctrine is the compassionate aspect of life. You don't have to be the most intelligent person in the world to study theosophy. All you have to do is love yourself and love everyone around you. Patience, and charity. So, compassion is the goal. Ultimate compassion for all. Buddha exemplified that, and he laid out his path that one can consider.
And one more thing, you said that family is the nucleus. Even Abdul Kalam Ji said that unity in family,
yes,
is most important. Then only you can spread harmony in the world.
Well, we see in all religions, family is very important. Even in Hinduism, it's talked about that aspect of life where one becomes a father and takes care of a family is a training ground. It's a training ground to take care of all of life. That is where one develops compassion, because no other place are we thrown together with other souls that we are connected with in some way that have a greater lesson to teach us. It's said that if we can show our compassion in our family to our brothers and sisters, to the ones that we don't get along with, but we still love them, even in spite of their differences. That is the basis of humanity. And we all are born into families. We're all born into families. So why are we here? Well, it's the school of life. But you have to love. And hopefully you are brought into a family of loving kindness, so where the soul can nurture and blossom forth. And so as a parent, that's what you try to do.
Yes.
You mentioned that we're all initiated. Could you expatiate on that?
Well,
how are we all, in a sense, initiated?
Yes.
What does that mean?
Are you sitting here? Are you in this room? Are you listening to what we're saying? This is an initiation. Knowledge of the truth is an initiation. The idea of reincarnation and karma is an initiation. You read the Secret Doctrine, you read the Ocean of Theosophy. There are ideas in there that were never spoken. They were hidden, they were secret, they were esoteric. The septenary nature of man, the septenary nature of the earth. You know, we have this higher principle, Buddhi or Atma. Well, that's on a plane of its own. That's of its own substance. That's of its own consciousness. And we have to elevate ourselves into that realm. So our initiation is what we are willing to accept and what we are willing to hear and what we are willing to make a living power in our life. So that's the initiation.
Yes.
Putting those two ideas together, in the ancient traditions, if you wanted to go further with your development, you had to ask every member in your family if they were ready to let you go. So family has equal importance.
Yes.
To our own development.
Yes, and we're asked not to be a theosophist and neglect our family duties. We have responsibilities. It's our dharma. We cannot neglect the responsibilities of life, because that doesn't make us any better. What makes us better is we deal with that which is in front of us.
So I'm hearing from all this that we have maybe benchmarks in our progress, but this is a continuing process. Even after becoming perfected, if you will, you know, we continue on in our progress and helping and just smart.
Yeah, well, it says in the first principle, eternal balance, immutable and omnipresent. That's what this universe is. And what we are experiencing is a period, just a period of manifestation, a period of development of the soul. But once we've graduated from the school, there's a higher education. It's boundless. There is no limit. We only limit it because of our mind and the ideas, as we are hearing, that we hold to be true. There's no intermediary between us and God.
Regarding the idea of the goal of religious life, we've heard a lot about making religion or spirituality practical in our everyday lives, the exemplification of the family, charity, the virtues. But in tying it in with the previous question, much of religious life seems, or the goal of religious life seems to be what happens to us after death, almost another otherworldliness. We see it in the different religions, whether it's nirvana or heaven or how might we look at that in a more universal way or from the point of view of reality?
Yes, one reality which everyone has a problem with and ignores most of their life is death. What is death? What happens? Where do we go? And how do we get there and be happy? Well, there's rituals that can be performed that can alleviate or can make us have a propitious existence. We can do certain rituals and we can have an extended stay in this blissful state. It's like we're going from Washington to New York. And we fall asleep. We fall asleep in Philadelphia, we fall asleep in New York, we find ourselves in New Haven. Before we know it, we're in Montreal. And we've missed all of this, where we could have learned something, where we could have participated. But now we've neglected it, and we will come back to it. We all have a lesson to learn. We all have a responsibility to life. Now, religion offers an explanation, but it's all short-sighted. We are eternal beings, boundless, immutable, and omnipresent. Hinduism speaks of it, but it's covered up. You know, one of the greatest books in Hinduism that was secret for years, for millennium, is the Bhagavad Gita. The Brahmins kept it secret because it was an answer, a entrance onto the path of how every pilgrim can enter it. And so, therefore, struggle with this, in this Garden of Eden, in this world of opposites, of this world of good and bad. But as Theosophists, nothing is good or bad. Everything is an opportunity. We just have to take advantage of that which we know and understand and that which comes to us.
One more question, thanks.
When you say of death, why can't we die at home? Why do we need to go to hospital until end we are in ICU and then we die? Why can't we die at home peacefully with our children, family, and you have to go one day? Whether you go in ICU, you may get extension for 2-3 days or whatever.
Well, this is a very compassionate question. And in Hinduism, you find families die at home. They don't take them anywhere.
Yeah.
They die in their home with their family is around them.
Yeah.
Buddhism is as well, where death is not an ending, but a beginning. It's a transition of states of consciousness. You're just changing your state of consciousness. You know, the body disintegrates, it goes back to the earth. But the higher trinity, the immortal soul, lives on. It never dies. And it comes back and it rests for a period of time until all the aspirations of a higher nature have been exhausted. And then tanha, the thirst for life, brings us back into life again. Guess what? We got a new brain. We got a new body. Let's go do it again. Our problem is we forget that we are eternal beings. And that each life may be a new brain, but deep within us is this knowledge. deep within us. So every time we come across it in the next life, reincarnation or our eternal nature, we're going to go, oh, whoa, oh. What about that interests me? What about that's true? We reawaken ourselves. So we are doing a service to ourselves, and we are doing a service to our family.
Thank you.
You want me to leave?
Never.
Come back?
Yes.
We were just thinking, maybe we'd do a little better if we got a report card once in a while. And karma doesn't seem so much to give us a sort of level, you know, sort of you're doing okay, but here's where you need to solve things.
Right.
So we think some of karma is kind of a mean teacher.
Well, to tie that idea of a report card in with the previous question about people's choices as to where they want to or where they are compelled to spend the last days of their life, does not the ICU very often represent, as the questioner say, a holding on, a clinging to this body, which at that state is obviously in a state of disrepair, in the vain hope, in the illusionary hope, in the misguided hope that there would be a little bit more experience of this material life. Well, from the point of view of wisdom, that's not a good mark on the book. That's, you failed the test of learning about life, that there is no beginning and end. There's always transition. You can't hold on to spring, even if you live in California. There's going to be a change in the environment. You can't hold on to anything that's temporary and impermanent like the body. So the sooner you learn to let go, to make that peaceful transition, in what other circumstance it is, in life or death, the more you've learned, you've earned the A in that report card. And as you said, karma brings us back, our actions, the results of our actions bring us back to learn from that experience. So we're going to change the order of our keys a little bit. On the program, you see that the path of action, meditation, is next, but we're actually going to switch to the next one of presentation. The way of faith and devotion as a twofold key to understand in each religion what they mean by faith and how do you pursue it, and what they mean by devotion and how do you pursue it, and besides the personal or the particular application, what's its universal implication. And in this, we're going to have a little variation. We're going to actually have two panelists up here, each presenting faith and devotion. So we invite our panelists up, and we'll step off to the side.
So in the way of faith, the universal paths in all religions, as we are talking about today, are focused on reaching the goals of religious life. However, we find that one religion or sect may emphasize one way more than the other. In Protestant theology, faith is primary. Martin Luther advocated that the just shall live by faith. In accepting and affirming the free gift of the grace of God, and Mahayana Buddhism, as mentioned before, is one of the most widely practiced traditions in East Asia. A popular sect in Japan being Pure Land Buddhism. This sect also highlights the way of faith, in that one needs grace and assistance of Amitabha Buddha. However, Buddha taught that one must work out their own solution. Faith is indeed a deep, fundamental human quality. With faith, all things are possible, say the ancient sages. Faith sets the will in motion. Through it, man links himself with the ideal upon which his heart is set. Faith surrounds any project with a living substance, making of it a unified whole capable of coordinated action among all its parts. Faith is twofold in nature, the higher having its roots in the immortal self, is pure, holy, and divine, and consequently has nothing to do with the reasoning of the brain. Fed from above by the fire of awareness and knowledge based on observation and experience, it makes no mistakes, for it looks directly to the heart of things. It is true wisdom, true enlightenment. It is man's noblest quality and divinest faculty, with potent creative power. The highest faith is pure, it is harmonious, in other words, sattvic. But the average person considers faith and belief to be identical, but they are an infinity apart. They can be connected only by one who wills to know. Belief, at best, is skin deep, as are emotions and the other powers of the lower mind. The believer may blindly accept what someone or something says, never questioning it and never moving from it. This lowest tamasic kind of faith may make one feel stable, but can lead to dogmatism and fanaticism. Among artists, intellectuals, and scientists, there are those whose belief expresses itself in life at the present moment, resting on something that itself is moving and is therefore unstable or rajasic. The voice of the silence tells us that our true self is a beam of light, immaculate within a form of clay. How do we ever unfold from within the wisdom to gain perfect mastery and control over our erring bodies unless we have indomitable faith based on knowledge that we have the power within to tread the path of our elder brothers who have become masters of wisdom? If we want the real faith, three things are necessary. Belief in oneself, belief in the law, and belief in those who perfectly embody the law. These three bring us, in our daily life, the ideal that sustains and inspires us to go on and on, higher and higher. It is by faith alone, that creative faculty of the higher mind, by which we envision the ideal and see reflected in the present the promise of what must be. To keep the faith means to hold the vision, to act on the basis of it alone through steadfast devotion to the immortal higher self. Absolutely.
Second is you have to have love.
You have to believe in yourself, believe in the law, which is nature's laws. and belief in those who perfectly embody the law, masters of wisdom, which you are too, we are God. So it's a process of recognizing that, demanding of that, of yourself to reach up and follow your conscience.
One more opportunity.
And now we'll talk about devotion. As gathered from all the previous discussions, these themes run through all of the religions. For instance, in the Western religions, devotion is mentioned, but it has a feeling of sympathy, love, commitment attached to it, which is of our feeling nature. And when we translate that, we'll see where it goes. In the East, devotion is a section of the path that one follows to reach to the goal. And the goal is also important. In the Eastern religions, for instance, Buddhism, there is the great image of the wheel, which is conditioned existence, and that of Buddha, which is unconditioned existence, and there is the path that leads from conditioned to unconditioned existence, which means freedom from earthly life and becoming one with the higher aspect of oneself. In the devotional books of the Hindus, it is referred to as bhakti yoga. And the Bhagavad Gita, which is the science, which is the book of devotion, which is the science of devotion, this dialogue, which is centered between Arjuna and Krishna, actually gives each human being the philosophy of the self that is spelled with the capital S, meaning the higher aspect, the divine aspect of the human being, and the personal aspect, which is the one that Christian theology promulgates most of the time as devotion, which is the personal aspect of life. In the Hindu system, bhakti is one of the meditative forms, the other two being jnana yoga, which is the path of knowledge, that of karma, which is action, and the third is bhakti, which is devotion. Now, when we look at the Gita and the explanation Krishna gives, it shows that human intelligence as developed at the present is still attached to the kamic nature, which is our desires and passions, which is our lower personality aspect. And in order to understand what true devotion is, we really need to understand how the mind works. Now, in the theosophical literature, and also in the Puranas, it makes the distinction that the personal aspect of life is guided by our desires and passions, which is our kamic nature. If we don't understand how to control that nature, it will be in the ascendancy because it is the most developed at this time. The true bhakti, Shankaracharya states it as being the reality of the self, which the previous speaker also talked about. How do we understand the reality of the self? Well, HPB, in many of her writings, states that what is attractive to the personality is like colored glass and colored feathers that the child is interested in. So the personality is also attached to certain things in life, and it follows it without ever thinking about as to where it is leading. True bhakti, which is devotion, is truly devotion to the higher self. In other words, everything that we assume to do is assumed as a service to bhakti, and bhakti here is Bhagavan, which is Krishna, which is our higher self. How do we conduct ourselves? Well, Mr. Judge has an article in Culture of Meditation where he states that if what we are doing doesn't go towards brotherhood, if it doesn't bring any good about, if it is harmful to a single thing, we're much better off not doing it. So that is saying all our activity which is undertaken as devotion to the higher self has to be altruistic. And that is quite a high standard to live by. How do I achieve it? Well, we'll go to the secret doctrine. When the mind beings, or manasaputras, which we are also, we are mind beings, Agnishvata Petris, gave humanity the fire of intelligence and ignited wisdom in humanity. This is what HPV writes in the Secret Doctrine. As a result of this ignition, the first feeling that was awakened in man was a sense of solidarity or oneness with his spiritual creators. As the child's first feeling is for its mother and nurse, so the first aspirations of the awakening consciousness in primitive man were for those whose element he felt within himself and who yet were outside and independent of him. Devotion arose out of that feeling and became the first and foremost motor in his nature, for it is the only one which is natural in our heart, which is innate in us, and which we find alike in human babe and the young of the animal. So we see that this innate feeling is there, and all of the religions that we discussed today have also brought forward that innateness of faith, of conviction that we are united, that we come from the same essence, is there. What is different here is that once the human being understands internally they are part of the whole and that they cannot move forward without affecting everything around them because they're connected to everything around them, they're halfway through that journey. What is the other half? The other half is the return journey to home, which is dependent on unity, on brotherhood, and on devotion to the welfare of everything that lives and exists in our universe and beyond. Remember, please, we're not just part of humanity, we're also part of the Deva world, our spiritual progenitors, and also the lower kingdoms who look up to men for guidance into their future evolutionary process.
Yes?
The expression, trust the law, we believe there's a secondary that goes with that, but rule the moment.
In other words, trust the law or believe in the law, but
absolutely.
Rule the moment. Could there be some thoughts?
Absolutely. There is nothing. The way this one is suited under Sanders, we live in the moment, and we don't live yesterday or today. In fact, all just is, and so that's part of ruling the moment. This student believes anyway, is that you have to trust. You have to, but trust with knowledge, knowingly. And go with what you believe
for,
in.
But for the soul, there is the eternal,
that's
which
the
is
eternal
the present
realm.
Moment.
Okay.
So if we are truly attuned to that inner guide, that's exactly what we are doing. We're not attached to anything. We do what is right for the moment and leave the result to the law.
Exactly.
Follow-up question?
Yes, because often, and there was a great title of a book, Talk spiritual life, I don't have to worry about all of these things. And they go without plans or direction, expecting everything to unfold in front of them, and then they don't understand why it all falls apart.
Well, without mm-hmm. effort, without action, which is the second part of this yoga system, there can be no improvement in our lives. Everything is based on action. But if we have the philosophy, the correct philosophy, the truth to base our action on, then we are moving in the right direction, hopefully.
With the love and have knowledge and all, you know, based on knowledge and so forth.
Well, that's what Mr. Judge says, that a human being who is devoted, if they also have the philosophy of the truth about themselves and the life in general, then the direction would be correct.
Well, I get it. It sounds like music to my ears. But how do I get in tune with that music?
You have to become absolutely quiet to be able to hear the inner music. And that is called yoga, which is meditation. In meditation, we are recommended to sit. That's actually your field. It is recommended that we sit every day at a certain period of the time, making sure that we make it an automatic process in the sense that you do it at the same time every day and in the same corner of your home. And you, in time, actually change the constitution of that corner, because elementals are affected by your thought process. And in that meditative half an hour, you go absolutely quiet. It isn't easy as it sounds. And when you actually achieve in doing it, that means that you have connected to your inner core, and that inner core becomes your guide in your activity. When it is there to assist you, it takes perhaps not one lifetime, but many lifetimes sometimes to achieve that kind of yoga, which HPB calls samadhi, highest trance that is available for human beings on earth. But it's possible.
Yes.
Well, this definition of devotion, it seems like it's the fabric of civilization, that this devotion to each other, otherwise, we could not function as a civilization, as a country. It is through cooperation. And this deep, as was said, this deep devotion to others. Is that a perspective?
In the research that this student has done, there were two kinds of devotion mentioned. One is apara bhakti, which it is stated is necessary for students of religion, for instance, true students of religion. At the beginning, perhaps they need an image to have in front of them to concentrate the mind, and it's okay to start that way. But in time, as a student who follows this path matures into it, it is recommended that the spiritual path, parabhakti, be constituted. In that, this absolute quietness is necessary in connecting to your inner core. That quietness is necessary. But it is also stated that all of the religious practices, whether they are ablutions, prayer, fasting, trying to meditate, is to promote this spiritual innate feeling. And what is stated is that the innate core, that imperishable core, is there, but if you don't activate it, it will not function in that manner. In other words, the higher mind with the light of buddhi on it, which is our spiritual discrimination, is what true bhakti is. And another name for it is service to humanity, which are exhibited best by the masters of wisdom. In this little explanation here, it was stated that serving the higher self and serving the masters are not exclusive of one another. They are complementary to one another. If our aim is truly to help humanity move forward with their understanding of who and what they are, what is the highest achievable possible, then we are really doing service to humanity by promulgating this philosophy, even if it is in adjunct to others, to make people understand that there is a higher path besides the religious path that is shown in a lot of books, then you become a lighted center that the Great Lodge perceives and recognizes. In other words, even if you don't know it, they assist you in the endeavor.
Thank you.
Summarize that for devotion, you have to rise above mind.
Above mind? You have to rise above mind to, in order to reach to the higher self, mind is the antaskarana, which is the bridge. Your lower mind is definitely attached to your personal self. But as you struggle in this endeavor, in meditation, in service, in charity, in learning who and what you are internally, that higher mind also comes to your assistance. You have to invite it in. And in time, it comes to your assistance because it can occupy and guide you. In other words, it's not of this plane. Higher mind, buddhimana, atma buddhimanas, which is the spirit, the spiritual discernment, and your divine mind is the trinity or the three aspects of you that go from one life to the next to the next. That's the imperishable or the permanent aspect, which is immortal. I'm sorry, I was done.
I have a question. Even though she's prettier than me. Can we lose our faith?
In the higher faith?
I would ask the gentleman, can we lose our faith?
Can we lose our faith?
Not the higher one.
Not the higher faith, yeah. Yes, what we perceive of as faith, yeah.
The higher faith,
well, the higher faith is
and devotion also go together, and you cannot lose it because it's the sattvic faith that you eventually convert to devotion.
Okay. Faith is so important to people's lives that while we as individuals and collectively as searchers for truth share these ideas, examine them with discrimination in all the different religions, none of us would cross the line and challenge the faith or belief of another if that faith, that devotion, was what held them up in life. Because to pull it away before there's some other inner foundation of truth and reality within themselves, to have them lose it would leave them in a worse condition. So there are many paths to the goal. There are many beliefs to the goal. And as said, at the beginning, we need an image. We need something outside for the mind to dwell on. But as we grow in our own understanding and we get some real inner wisdom, the faith moves from outside ourselves to within our own nature. And then nobody can take that faith away, and no one can lose it. It follows one from life to life. So we've looked at a number of keys to the universal themes, and this last presentation was actually to be made by two other students who unfortunately are ill and unable to attend or participate. However, we do have some of their notes, and we'll do our best to transmit these ideas.
on the path of action and meditation. So when we say the path of action, we'll start with that first. We're talking about the path of disciplined action or prescribed duties, ritual observances that we see in whatever religion we may want to examine. And as it is with all of these paths, we've talked about the four paths, in one religion and even within a sect of that religion, there can be more of an emphasis on devotion or meditation or ritual or meditation than in the other sect or religion. But it's there. It's there as an element. And so the importance of this idea of ritual action is the worldwide intuitive understanding of people of all different faiths that there is a connection between their behavior in this world to their status in the world to come, whether it is in heaven or whether it is in a future life or whether it is to avoid hell or whether it is even to reach spiritual illumination and an understanding of the world beyond the physical while incarnated in the world experience. So there is a connection. So what happens in this world matters. Spirituality is not an otherworldliness. It's bringing into our physical action the fire, the potency of spiritual understanding. And good deeds are relevant to the final stature, the final status of the soul, of the individual. Of course, in the East, we have this idea of karma, of cause and effect, action and reaction. But it's found in other traditions, in the Golden Rule, of course, and so forth, expressed in different ways. So we can look at Hinduism, and we can see that there are different castes. And the original idea of the caste system before it became a social restrictive institution was the acknowledgement that within human beings there are certain general tendencies, that we are all in some case a teacher or a priest, a teacher of knowledge, and so we had the priestly caste. We all are in the sense of fighters. Maybe we're just fighting for the next breath in the ICU. Or maybe we're fighting to get our kids off to school in time before the bus leaves. Or maybe we're just fighting for the recognition of equal rights in our community. But we're all fighters. We're warriors. And so that's a human element. And then the idea of we're all merchants, that there is a transmission of goods and services, of sharing of commodities, whether it's experience, whether it's services, whether it's goods, that all of us share those things. And of course, there are servants. We're all a servant to something higher or someone higher in our lives. So these general tendencies in some show more than others. And so in the Hinduism, there are certain duties that relate to someone who might be born in a certain caste. And in the same way, there are certain stages throughout life. The student has a certain duty, as does the householder, as does the forest dweller, and then the sage who wanders and teaches. In Islam, as we said, there are the five pillars of faith, which are disciplined ways to remain faithful and devoted and remembrance of God. So the Islamic life provides structure to all aspects of life, every day of the year, every month of the year, every second of one's life. There is something involved, some ritual. So it is a comprehensive way of life. in its pure ethical basis. And of course, in Judaism, we have the idea of the Ten Commandments, and the Torah, the written law, actually includes 613 laws, each of which are studied. So when we say the people of the book, or in the Jewish tradition, you have the rabbi who is the master of all these laws, the teachers, and the community of individuals could study with the teacher all of these laws and how to apply them. So we have the laws of being kosher, of the Sabbath, of holidays, of the bar mitzvah, of circumcision. And in we see it even in Buddhism with the monastic community. Christianity has their sacraments and tithing. So the point is that there is a ritualistic activity in religions, all religions. Now, when we look at this idea from the theosophical point of view, we are essentially mind beings. We are thinkers. We are choosers. We are intelligent, but everything in life has some degree intelligence. The difference is we can self-consciously choose what we will think, what we will do, what action will we take. We can understand the law and choose to go against it if we will. We can have instincts and choose to ignore them. The kingdoms below the human nature cannot do that. But we are mind beings. And so all our action, as taught in the Bhagavad Gita, begins in the mind. And so in the Bhagavad Gita, you have this idea of the false pietist, of the bewildered soul, the individual who, believing very much in ritualism and the austere life of the ascetic, may go out into the woods and perform very important ritualistic sacrifices and completely isolate themselves from the community, and yet in their mind they're still dwelling on all these delights and sensations and memories. Well, they are false pietists. So from theosophical point of view, the disciplined action is that of the disciplined use of the mind. And so we will see as we move into the understanding of yoga and meditation. In Krishna defines for us two different paths: the path of action, physical action, service, devotion, and the path of mental action or understanding or meditation. And we see this, it's not just in Hinduism, it's seen in all the different religions. We see a mental devotion, a meditative practice, and a outer physical one. And so Theosophy would say that if we are going to be disciplined, the important discipline is in the careful examination and monitoring and awareness of how we are thinking about things, how we are feeling about things, what we are saying. It's not just following an outer rule of prescribed practice. It's following the inner ruler. The previous speakers brought out the idea of coming to, in our silence, a recognition of the core of our inner enlightenment within ourselves. It's judging ourselves, discriminating our actions in the light of our own inherent wisdom. Simply put, being true to ourselves. And so all the virtues, all the rituals mean nothing if the thought, the motive, the heart behind it. One could preserve in their lives from morning till night, perform every ritual perfectly. If their motive was selfish, it's worse than having no rituals at all, because it creates much more destructive influence for oneself and others. So that's the real discipline. Now, when it comes to meditation, once again, we tend to draw a line in our mind. Action is the outer physical observance, and meditation is something different. It's the mind. Krishna says it's children to think that the two are different, that right action and right mindfulness are one and the same. You cannot perform right action without the right attitude of mind, and you can't have the right attitude of mind if you're not performing your actions and your duties in life, that they're one and the same, that all actions should be performed as a service, as a devotion, as a sacrifice to the highest in oneself, to the highest in life, for the benefit of humanity. And to do that, one needs to be constantly aware and meditating. So there is this idea in theosophy of the life line or the life's meditation. And we could say we all have a life's meditation. The mother who wakes up in the morning, or sometimes 3 o'clock in the morning at the slightest whimpering of her child, has a lifetime's meditation, and that is the welfare of the child. And everything in their life is centered, all their thoughts are centered around the child's welfare. The true healer, the meditation of the true healer is the benefit and the patient. And the method of healing is only the instrument by which they carry out their life's meditation. Same way with a teacher. And throughout, there's a certain thread, but we can see that through study and self-examination that we can raise the lifeline's meditation. We can become a mother to others. We can extend that feeling of motherhood devotion we have to our child to all children. We can become a teacher to the young, the old, and we can become a learner from other teachers. So we can build our life's meditation, make it broader, make it wider, make it higher. But there is also the idea of setting aside, as was said, some time for meditation. Now, there are many different systems of meditation. We can go from the mantras, the reciting of specific words and frequencies of words to produce a certain spiritual, mental, psychic, or even physical, physiological effect, and one can meditate on those things. And we can go to the other extreme, which is a pure negation of all physical ideas, a perfect kind of passivity of mind where we try to make our minds a complete blank. There's the entire realm. And theosophy has much to teach on both extremes. But if we take the idea of Buddhism, that of right mindfulness as part of the path, it is well for us to understand that when we meditate from the theosophical point of view, we are employing the system in the East called Raja Yoga as opposed to Hatha Yoga. Hatha Yoga is recognized to be certain practices relating to the breathing, to the postures, to the use of sound that have their effect. But Raja Yoga is the disciplined meditation and activity of the mind. And as the primary exponent of that system, Patanjali, said, the soul is vision itself that looks directly on ideas. And that's the kind of meditation that we try to aspire to. But that takes practice. That's a skill. We're not used to using that. Our minds have a certain motion and activity, and they run in all directions. So to quiet the mind does not mean to bring it into passivity. It means to concentrate it. It means to focus it. When you run water through a sieve, it's not focused. It's spread out. It's weak. When you run water through a funnel, that same body of water has a force that it didn't have before. And so too, our ideas, when they're focused, when they're made one-pointed, have a much greater potency, a much greater action than they do otherwise. That's why the action and meditation are one and the same, according to Krishna. So we talk about a kind of meditation. We set aside a certain time of the day, in the morning or the evening, a time for reflective review, a mindfulness of how we conducted our lives and whether or not it lived up to our own highest standards. And as Krishna says at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, from that, from all this discussion, all this meditation, act as seemeth best unto thee. And that's always an evolving process. So we're going to stop here and just take the remainder of the time to answer your questions or hear your comments on this subject, or if there were any other comments or questions that were left over from any of the other presentations today. Yes?
Several, 11 years ago, I recall having met a group of individuals who practice Buddhism, and one person from that group made a comment that always made me think and wonder if it was true to it or not. The person was saying that she believed that Buddhism it could be considered to be even older than Christianity and several other religions, and that because of the age, it has had more time to evolve, perhaps to an extent where it can promote non-judgmental practices like you mentioned. Do you agree with that point of view, that it's the age of the religion that has allowed it to evolve more, or not?
Well, there is much judgmentalism in the East as there is in the West. We don't have the market on that. Of course, there is prejudice, but that's a human quality. That's part of the conquering of ourselves that needs to become, that needs to be acquired. That's overcoming the reality behind illusion. Now, it is true that there is an accumulated wisdom of the ages. That is the experience of great wise beings in all different parts of the world. But they are not—they're not saying that this is our exclusive teaching. This is not our final declaration of truth. This is saying this is the result of ages of testing and checking and verifying what is true. So, in a sense, if you just learn—if you're a scientist, and this is a science, it's a science of spiritual life. That's what religion ultimately is. If you're a scientist and you conduct one experiment, that's great. But to the extent that that experiment verifies your observation over many, many years, and not just you do it, but many other people do it, the more time, the more experience, the more confidence you have it in it being a truth. Now, whether you're going to follow that truth is another thing. But the founders, what we say, the reformers of the different religions, whether we're talking about Buddhism, or the Buddha coming to was a reformer, and his teachings became codified in a certain religious system, or Jesus, his teachings become codified. None of these wrote down anything. It was all their pupils that wrote things down and people later believed in. They all shared the same wisdom. They all tapped into that fount of timeless wisdom. The question came before, how are we initiated? Well, we had the opportunity today to tap into a fount of universal wisdom that's been around and been everywhere for ages, but maybe we weren't aware of it. Now we're aware of it. What we do with it is a test of our own natures. Yes?
But isn't it also true that certain individuals in their previous lives might have also been initiated into the wisdom religion and they just don't remember it in this one, and that's why that attraction is there?
Yeah. Well, we started out with our teaching about the myth about the Garden of Eden. Well, if you're a student of the mythology and symbolism of the world and all the different scriptures, you know that the symbol of the serpent is not just one of the deceiver. The serpent was also a symbol of wisdom. Even Jesus said, "Be ye wise as serpents and harmless as doves." So the serpent has always been a symbol of the transmitter of knowledge. And according to the various religious traditions and mythologies, and also from the perspective we have, the teachings we have in theosophy, At one point in the history of early humanity, we had a human form that at some point became enlightened with self-consciousness. And that history, or that prehistoric history of our development as human being, is recorded in the mythology of the Garden of Eden. The idea of humanity represented by Adam and Eve tasting of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. But the acquirement of mind is as much our savior as it is our downfall, because we have freedom to choose. We can use our minds to have mastery and be cruel to people or to help people. So in a sense, our problems as humanity on this period of evolution can date back to the acquirement of mind. You know, it has a lower aspect and a higher aspect. And so as mind beings, if this took place, it is said, many millions of years ago, 18 million years ago, as incarnated mind beings, we've been through all experiences. We've been in every religious tradition of the modern times, of the ancient times. We've tasted at the wells of Buddhism, of Hinduism, of Egyptian religions, of Asian religions, of ancient American religions. We've acquired into our nature all that knowledge, all that initiation. So we come here into this life and we hear certain ideas and it resonates. Something sounds familiar. It may be a new word that we haven't heard before, but it touches, it awakens a memory, a feeling of recognition in ourselves. And now we have a word or a symbol that we can all say, oh yes, I see that. That corresponds to something I had in my, some bit of knowledge I had in my nature, but didn't know how to express. So now we can communicate on the outer plane with certain ideas that we all share in the secretness, in the esoteric nature, the hidden nature of our being. And so, yes, individuals and groups of individuals have been through many different initiations in the past. So we'll take one more question and then we'll wrap it up.
Well, there's a concept East of talking about Buddha, but the transmission of this wisdom, and it's called the Guru Parampara chain, that it's passed down from generation to generation, from time immemorial. That I think was mentioned, that we are responsible for sharing this knowledge in the world, so we become part of that chain.
So the Guru Param chain is the idea of a long line of teachers or instructors, but it just doesn't refer to the saints and the mystics and the wise men and the brothers and the adepts of all different traditions. It goes down to the family, the wisdom that the parent transmits to the child from their teachers, from their inspiration. And so we have, from the highest to the lowest, this passing on of the light of wisdom, of this chain. And considering that life is a school and we are all students, then there must be the teachers, or at least those who have passed through the stages we are going through, have learned the lessons, and now out of their compassion and devotion are here to teach us. We have the record of their lives, the record of their teachings, and the record of their influence. And to the extent they represent an ideal and a fact that we can all aspire to. So we'd like to finish by thanking you all to putting aside your valuable time joining with us in this mutual effort to gain a better understanding of the universal themes that run throughout all the religions, but not just from an intellectual point of view, so we can transmute that into heart energy, bhakti, to create a greater devotion to the interests of others, as well as our own highest interests. Our meeting together is adjourned.
You see, if you have a guru, you have 100 kilometers
of travel. I can't hear you. I couldn't hear you. Wait, let me just turn this off. I'm sorry, what were you saying?